On this episode, the first of a special 5-part series, January 6th, Views from the House. Recently, we spoke with 14 members of Congress. They shared their stories about where they were and what they saw on January 6th when a mob stormed the U.S. Capitol trying to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. This week, we hear from Representative Mark Wayne Mullen, Republican of Oklahoma, Jason Crow, Democrat of Colorado, and Tom Malinowski, Democrat of New Jersey. The first voice you'll hear is former Vice President Mike Pence, who was presiding over the joint session that day.
Madam Speaker, members of Congress, pursuant to the Constitution and the laws of the United States, the Senate and House of Representatives are meeting in joint session to verify the certificates and count the votes of the electors of the several states for President and Vice President of the United States.
At 1 p.m. on January 6th, the House and Senate met in joint session to count the electoral votes of the 2020 presidential election. An hour later, a mob entered the Capitol with the intention of disrupting the vote. As the protesters moved closer to the Senate and House chambers, Vice President Pence and Speaker Pelosi were evacuated to safe locations. Minutes later, security officials ushered House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer and other congressional leadership off the House floor. With tension rising in the building, the House and Senate abruptly recessed.
Without objection, the House is going to go back into recess.
There were a few dozen members of Congress in the House chamber at that time, including Oklahoma Republican Mark Wayne Mullen and Colorado Democrat Jason Crow. First, Representative Mark Wayne Mullen, who talks about his recollection of being on the House floor that day.
I'm pretty observant of what's going on around me. And so we were sitting there. We were just starting, the debate. And I started noticing a lot of activity with Capitol Police and with the Sergeant of Arms. I started hearing, you could hear their earpieces, which is unusual. Usually there's no traffic in their earpieces, but I could hear their earpieces because there was one near to me and it was getting pretty exciting. And unfortunately, I've been in those situations before overseas, and I recognized that there was an issue really quick. In fact, I looked over at Congressman Jason Smith, who was beside me, and I said, "Something's happening." And he goes, "What?" And I said, "Something's going on." And then it was just a matter of a minute or so later that people started looking at their phones because Twitter's feed started going off. I don't get alerts on my Twitter feed because that would drive me nuts, but a lot of people do. And that was my first indication that something was happening. And then things started moving pretty quick then.
So you are where in the chamber at this point?
First, I was second or third row. I think I was the second row on the front, on the Republican side, on the right side, kind of towards the middle.
And where are the police officers that you are able to hear what's happening in their earpieces?
Well, they were running up and down, not running, but they were moving up and down the aisle. So I was sitting right on the aisle in the middle section on the side, and they were going in front of the aisle and then right in the what we call the well, which is the front part. And so it was clear that something was happening. And then the lieutenant came to the mic and said that I'll just kind of start walking through it. The lieutenant came to the mic and he said they have breached the Capitol and they're in the Capitol building. They're in the Senate. We have a feeling that they may be coming this way. And then about that time, they came rushing in and rushed out. Pelosi and I think Scalise. I know McCarthy wasn't there. I don't know if Hoyer was there or not, but I know Scalise's guys came in, and I know Pelosi's guys came in, and they took them out. At that time, Lieutenant came to the mic and said, "We're going to go on lockdown, and if they breach the floor or if they breach the door, he wants everybody to lay down." And as I said, I've been in these situations before, unfortunately. Similar, nothing exactly the same.
Can you explain for people who don't know your background?
I'd probably prefer not to, and I'm sorry. I just don't want to get into that. But I had he said to, for everybody to get in and lay down. And I stood up at that point and I said, sir, you're wrong. And I turned around to everybody and I said, do not lay down on the floor. I said, everybody, if they hit that door, we need to go out those doors and down those steps. And then the lieutenant walked over to me and I said, sir, I mean, no disrespect, but you don't lay down during a riot. That's how you get people killed. People are going to get stomped. They're going to get walked over. I mean, people that get hurt are the people that lose their footing during a riot. And he understood that. And he was very receptive. And like I said, there's still a lot of noise going on in his earpiece, and he was trying to make decisions the best he could. What my observation was is that Capitol Police and Sergeant Orange did the best they could, and they were doing the best they possibly could with the training and equipment they had. The problem was is that they weren't really trained for it, and they had no contingency plans on how to get members or get people off the floor in a case like that. The first thing you have to do is have a contingency plan. When you're dealing with a situation like that, you should have a contingency plan A, B, and C, and each one of your contingency plans should have a contingency plan on how to do it. It was very evident right off the bat that they didn't have any idea how to get the members or get the staff off the House floor, but they were willing to react. And so what I enjoyed about it is the fact that Capitol Police and Sergeant Orange was willing to do something. They never froze up. They're willing to react, but they didn't actually have the training or the protocols put in place to be able to do what properly needed to be done. Now, anytime you go through these situations, you can always debrief them 50,000 times and come up with 50,000 different solutions that you could have done better. So they were doing the best they could in those situations. And when I started explaining to the lieutenant, just in brief, I mean, very brief, because things were happening very quick, he was very receptive of it. But by then, they had already put us on lockdown. It was just a matter of seconds before we heard them hit the first set of doors.
Which doors are you talking about if you're looking
at? Well, if you're coming out of the statuary hall running to the House floor, there's two sets of doors. So there's doors right in the hallway. Then there's a small gap, like a small little foyer. And I don't know if you even consider it a foyer, but it's a small little area where you walk up a couple steps before you enter into the actual chamber. And there's a set of doors there. So the first set of doors are the ones that are actually in the hallway. And we heard them hit the door. I grabbed one of the Capitol Police individuals, which was on a detail. So he was in a suit. So he was part of someone's detail. And I actually think he was part of Scalise's detail who stayed behind. I'm not 100% sure on that, but I think it was. We go out, or we run over to the Republican side corner and grab a desk, and we bring it over there to put it in front of the doors. And then someone else grabbed a bench and put it on top of it. So we stacked furniture in front of the door, and you can see pictures of that. And then the sergeant came back on, and he said that they've deployed tear gas and wanted people to put the gas hoods on, because underneath every chair there's gas hoods. Problem is, and I've joked about this for years, is we have all these gas hoods and stuff, but they've never showed us how to do it. They never showed anybody ever. Once again, lack of training, which was a failure of leadership. That wasn't the failure of the guys that were in there working. They were doing everything they could, but it was a lack of contingency plans, and they failed at it. And they start telling everybody to put their hoods on, but no one knew how to put them on. And then there was a huge issue with people trying to put them on. I kind of questioned the fact that we needed to put it on anyways because of tear gas, because they deployed the tear gas in the rotunda and nowhere near us. So sometimes when you do that, you actually cause people to actually panic a little bit, but no one did. The members handled it very well. Capitol Police was reacting. Like I said, they weren't doing nothing. They weren't freezing up. They were reacting the best they could without clear direction. And then just a second later, they broke through the first set of doors, and then they hit the second set of doors. Now they're right there.
Are you still right there, Congressman?
Yes. Myself and Troy Nils were two congressmen. Troy Nils, Sheriff Nils, were the two members that were right there. Because when I stood up, I went to the back of the room because I knew I could be of assistance. I knew I could be an asset. I wasn't trying to do their job for them. They were going to do their job, and they were going to do what it took to they were going to do their job, what it took to protect us. And I felt very confident in that, but I also knew they could be easily overran. And so I went back there to try to be an asset. Some of these guys that were back there were friends of mine. Some of these guys I've talked to multiple times. And we've talked about certain cases and certain things that we've done in the past. And so I knew these guys. And so when I stepped back there, I actually took off my tie and took off my jacket, and Sheriff Nils, he stood up and he said, are we doing this, brother? And I said, do we have a choice? And he immediately jumped in right beside me. And then Tony Gonzalez jumped in. And then I believe it was Ronnie Jackson. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was Ronnie Jackson who also was going to be a willing participant and help, you know, keep them from breaking in. It was just a second later that they I think it was just a second later that they broke the glass. And when they first broke it, they used a glass punch, and it sounded like gunshots. And they started yelling, shots fired. And I actually thought shots were fired too. And I jumped because behind the chairs, behind the chairs have Kevlar behind the chairs, which are bullet resistant. And they're designed that way just because of the shooting we had, you know, in the chamber back in the 50s. And so I jumped behind there, and then I quickly realized that was a glass punch because I looked at the holes, and you could clearly tell the holes, they were from a glass punch. And so I yelled back, don't shoot, because now all the Capitol Police has got their guns drawn and they're yelling. And by the time you present your weapon like that and you're in those kind of situations, I'll tell you, Capitol Police showed great restraint by not opening fire because everybody thought shots were fired. And for the fact that they didn't discharge their weapon when they presented the weapon, they were using their head. They were thinking, even though they may have lacked training, they didn't lack discipline. And the Capitol Police showed great restraint in that. I mean, there's a lot of situations, especially overseas, that in those circumstances, shots would have started been firing in the opposite direction and people would have lost their lives. So Capitol Police did a great job by showing restraint. When I realized that it wasn't shots fired, I started to holler. I mean, this is just, all this happened very quick. I mean, so this is a matter of 3 seconds. I started yelling, no shots, no shots, don't fire, don't fire, don't shoot. Actually, I was saying, don't shoot. And then I went to the glass, and they were there, and the rioters are there, and they're being very belligerent to some degree. And I started yelling, is it worth it? Is it worth it? You almost got killed. Is it worth it? And one of the guys said, what? And I said, you almost died. Is it worth it? And the guy stopped. And at that time, they quit beating on the door. This time, they were really shaking and beating on the door. And they quit beating on the door, and they stopped. And they didn't respond for a second. And then what we call an agitator, anytime you had those crowds like that, and people have ill intentions, you know, there are professional agitators that can get people stirred up. I mean, you can take five agitators, and they can get a crowd of 1,000 plus stirred up really, really quick, especially if they know what they're doing. And what I would consider a true agitator, I would say he's probably a professional agitator. I don't know. I don't have his history. We didn't do a deep dive on who he is. But he definitely came to the front, and he started talking and started stirring. And the words he was using are key words that people use when they're trying to agitate a crowd. He had lost the crowd. You know, once an agitator gets a crowd going, they don't take the lead. They let the crowd take the lead. They fall back. But once they settle down, they jump back in front and they start trying to stir everybody back up. That's why I say this guy was part of a professional agitator. He came to the front and he started using words that, quite frankly, it keyed off on me. And I hollered at him and I says, I'd put you down. And I said, I'd put you down. And the guy looked at me and he says, this is our house. I said, it's our house too. He says, yeah, but this is our effing house. And I said, it's our house too, and we're not going to let you come in. At that point, things kind of went to a stalemate. And Someone else hollered for something, and I went over, and the lieutenant and I were talking back and forth this time. But Sheriff Nils, he stayed right there in front of that door the whole time. Sheriff Nils, at some point, Troy Nils from Houston, he started engaging with them too, talking to them back and forth. And he's a sheriff. I mean, he definitely knows what he's doing too. And that guy stayed put. And I don't know what Tony, I really lost track of what Tony and Ronnie at the time were doing. But at some point during that exchange, they had went around to the speaker's lobby over on the side. And we started hearing commotion there. And that same lieutenant, we were all focused on that front door, what I call the front door. Some people call it the back chamber, but it's the door that that when we're in joint session that this guest walked through, or when the president of the United States is addressing, you know, the joint session and getting the State of the Union, it's the doors he goes through. That's what I call the front doors. Some people call it the back of the chamber. But at some point, the back started happening, and they started evacuating people. But in the meantime, while this was all going on, they started evacuating people down those steps that I told people to go through and get out. They unlocked the chamber and started getting people through. But during this time, they evacuated the floor, but the balcony was still locked up, and we still had members in the balcony. Because of COVID, we were all separated, so they wanted to open the balcony. Instead of having guests up there, it was actually members that were up in the balcony. They were still locked in, because the only way to get out of the balcony is you actually have to go into the hallway, and it's unsecured area. Well, it's always a secured area, but in this case, it was an unsecured area because that's where the riders were. And they started hitting the back door, which the back door by the speaker's lobby is just glass. I mean, it's there's a lot of glass there. And I think there's a lot of video out there that shows this unfortunate situation that took place. And the lieutenant had a post up back there. And what I mean by post up, he had to take a position. And the lieutenant, by my account, he was by himself. All the rest of us, it wasn't very many of us that was still on the floor that was trying to protect the floor. And the sergeant of arms and this Capitol Police, and they were all piled up, like I said, shorthanded, doing a phenomenal job, doing the best they could, still protecting members, was still going to put their life on the line to protect us, doing an outstanding job with the tools and the training they had. They were doing the best they could. But I looked out, I turned around, and I could see where the lieutenant was posted up, and I couldn't hear what he was saying because there was a lot of commotion. There was commotion going on in the front of us. There was commotion going on back there. But from my perspective, I could see that I felt like he was alone. And he was obviously in a position because he had to draw his weapon, and I saw him posted up with his weapon. And I could tell he was given some kind of commands. I couldn't tell exactly what he was saying. I couldn't even tell what he was saying at all. I couldn't make it out. But you could tell he was in a little bit of a situation. And my mind started going on, if they breach that door, we're going to have to engage them really quick. And that engagement would be whatever it took to stop them. And I know I was prepared. I know the people that was with me was prepared to do whatever it took to stop them.
You didn't though, Congressman, have a weapon.
You don't always have to have a weapon to do certain things, but there's a lot of things happen in those situations. And, you know, you're going to react where you got to react. It's kind of like the front door. If they came through that front door, we knew that was going to be a choke point, or I knew it was going to be a choke point. And the idea to slow them down when they go through that front door, what I call the front door is the back chub of the chamber, is that you pile them up right there. And if you create a dog pile, then it slows people down and allows people, it creates a chaos. And so you pile them up at that choke point, you pile them up. And that's a true choke point that you have. You have an opportunity to stop a lot of the people being able to rush in because you pile them up right there. And that's a technique that you can use. Well, and that back door by the speaker's lobby, that's not an option. That's a lot wider area. It's still the choke point, but not very big. It's not a very good one. It's pretty wide. And once they come in, they can scatter through all over the place.
Do you think that is why that, I believe you said it was the lieutenant who was posted up. Is that the person we see in the video that you referenced? Now, do you think he was posted up because of what you just described?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He did not want to use lethal force at all. This guy is later in his career. I guarantee you, I don't know for a fact, but I guarantee you he's never had to pull his weapon in a manner like that before. He was the last person in the world that ever wanted to use force like that. And he wasn't wanting to do that. I know for a fact, because after it happened, he came over and he was physically and emotionally distraught. And I actually gave him a hug and I said, "Sir, you did what you had to do." And I mean that. Unfortunately, the young lady, her family's life has changed, and it was an unfortunate situation that she lost her life, and some people lost their loved ones. But the lieutenant's life has also changed too, because if it's the first time you've ever had to use lethal force, that doesn't ever leave you. And it wasn't his choice. He didn't show up to work that day to have to do that. He was doing his job, and he got put in a situation where he had to do his job because there was members still in the balcony. And if you're going to present your weapon in a manner and give commands and they still don't listen and they still approach, you don't have a choice, because either you have to at that point discharge your weapon in a manner of self-defense, or that weapon's going to be taken away from you. It's going to be used on you, and it's going to put all of our lives in danger too. So he did, but I believe that he saved actually other people's lives along the way, because I think there would have been a lot more that would have lost their lives, because we wouldn't have had a choice but to use lethal force at that point. Mind you, there were still a lot of members in the balcony and there was a few still left on the floor. Most had already evacuated though. And as it was an unfortunate situation. This was a very dark day in American history that should have never, ever, ever happened. And all of us are to blame on this one. I mean, Republicans, Democrats, the media, the administration, all of us, because we have to learn a different way to debate. What we use as politicians and as media is little key phrases, little key things to get people aroused, to get people excited, to get people's attention. The problem is we do that so much that turns into anger. And this went too far. This is something that's been bubbling too long, and it caused a dark day on American history. It's going to be there forever. I didn't want to be there. It's an unfortunate situation. I wish I was never there. But I was, and I had to react the way that I had to react, and other people reacted the way they had to react. But immediately after what the lieutenant had to do, we still had people up top, and I saw Jason Crow, who's a congressman from Colorado. I saw him pick his head up, and Jason and I have worked out a lot together. Politically, we are on totally different islands. We don't get along when it comes to politics, but we get along personally. And Jason and I had a lot of workouts together, because I run a workout group in the morning. He's one of them that's there quite often. And he poked his head up, and I said, "Jason, get him out." I knew he had a military background. I said, "Jason, get him out." And he says, "The doors are locked." I said, "Break the door. Get him out." And then there was a sergeant that was up there that was looking for keys to unlock the door. They got him some keys. They started unlocking, in my opinion, the wrong door, because they were going to go out the door that was going to lead them right down to where the riders were. And I said, "No, they're wrong. Other door, go out this door." And so they unlocked the door. They went out and they evacuated. And as soon as they got out, then the rest of us left the floor. And then I went to the triage center, which I haven't seen a thing like that since, stuff you see overseas. And I started realizing actually the restraint, even more so what our Capitol Police did. Now, I keep this in mind, they had two options. They could be passive or use lethal force. They didn't have weapons to be less lethal. Pepper spray is not less lethal. Pepper spray may settle down one person. Pepper spray is not designed to stop a riding crowd. It doesn't work that way. But they didn't have less lethal weapons when it comes to rubber bullets or to bean bags that they could shoot. To put out warning shots, basically, for them to stop before they escalated to the lethal. They could use less lethal, then have to use that. They either had to be passive and use little bite guards to try keeping them from going through, taking hits to the face, or they had to escalate it to actual lethal force. And when they decide to pull the weapon, then you have to use it. You don't have a choice, like that lieutenant. You don't have a choice. And the lieutenant had to do what he had to do because he had to protect us. But when I went down the triage center, I saw at least 50 guys, and I shook all their hands and I thanked them for what they were doing. I went down there before I went to the lockup room where everybody was at, just to check on them. I went to the triage center first. I'd lock up, and I don't say lockup area. It was a holding area. No one was locked in the room. Members at the Ways and Means, you could come and go if you want to. The media said they were locked in there. That's actually not true. You could come and go as you want. But before I went there, I went and checked on all the Capitol Police. And man, I saw 50 guys at least, shook their hands. Guys meaning men and women, from the DC police to Sergeant Barnes to the Capitol Police, uniformed and non-uniformed officers that were, I mean, broken noses, busted up faces, broken arms, busted heads. I saw one guy with his eye completely gouged out, literally, and they were trying to evacuate him, but he couldn't because they couldn't get medical services in there to get him to where he needed to go. Luckily, his eye was saved, but he's going to lose some vision in it. I saw guys that were hyperventilating. I saw guys that had got hit with pepper spray. And I thought, you know, you just think about this. They showed so much restraint because they weren't afraid to put themselves their body in harm's way. They weren't cowards. They stood the line, took a beating, and they showed so much restraint that they could have killed that individual. They're attacking a police officer. Any place, if you got in a fight on the side of the street with an officer, that officer has every opportunity to use lethal force at that point because his life's in danger. Their lives were in danger, and they could have easily used lethal force if they wanted to. But they had great restraint because they were probably at all, too, that these are American citizens. And I really want to escalate it that far, but they had to calculate this by themselves, and they didn't. If it was any other country, this was any other place in the world, and that would have happened to a government building, there would have been countless people that would have lost their lives. But these officers were willing to show enough restraint that they were putting their actual body in harm's way when they had a firearm on their side and didn't decide to use it. I think they are absolutely heroes. I don't know if I could have done that. I honestly don't know if I would have been able to do that, but they did. And not just a few of them, but a lot of them did. And it's remarkable to me that unfortunately only one person lost their lives by a gunshot. And it's unfortunate. I will say it's unfortunate. But it could have been so much worse.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Also in the chamber that day was Jason Crow. The Colorado Democrat was just 3 days into his second term on Capitol Hill. He talked about how his day began on January 6th.
My scheduler actually texted me that there was a spot available to sit in the gallery and watch the opening of the debate. I wanted to debate. I wanted to have my voice heard in that process and try to refute the lies and the conspiracy theories that were being sown by some of my colleagues. But I didn't have a slot yet. So my scheduler told me that she had a slot for the first hour and asked me whether I wanted to do it. And I think I texted back, sure, why not? So I finished the work I was doing and grabbed a quick lunch at the cafeteria in Longworth, and then just about around 12:30 walked over to the Capitol to go into the gallery and to join some of my colleagues. And you know, there was a tension in the air. It was an overcast day. My family had actually decided to leave early. They were originally scheduled to fly back to Colorado the next day on the 7th, but we decided to have them leave on the 5th because of the planned protests and just not wanting them and the kids to be around in case anything happened. So there was a kind of an ominous feeling leading up to that. But I you know, that morning I had confidence that the Capitol Police would be able to address anything that came up.
So you decide to make your way over to the Capitol, and where in the chamber did you go and what were you doing?
Well, I went up to the gallery level and checked in with some of the staff there. They had a checklist of the members who they were expecting to go up, and they were trying to space folks out because of COVID. So there was about two dozen of us that sat up on the gallery side, on the Democratic side of the gallery. There were, I don't remember there being any Republicans on their side of the gallery. Many of them were down on the floor. But the way that we had it planned, the Democrats, was just those who were speaking and debating would be on the floor, and those who were observing would be in the gallery. So about two dozen of us took our seats, spaced out, and watched as the speaker gaveled in the proceedings, and as the Senate came over and the vice president came over, and we were watching it and saw the opening debates. And at the same time, many of us were sitting up with our phones open, looking at the protest and what was happening, and then saw that as it came to the Capitol and turned from a protest into a violent mob, and the clashes with police started.
So you are aware of the protesters approaching the Capitol because you're following the news on your phone, not because you've received communication from security personnel at the Capitol.
That's right. We were following it on social media and on news feeds on our phone. And actually saw as they hit the first barricade and started to fight with police, and heard the chants of you know, kill them and bring out the guillotine and build the gallows. We saw and heard all of that happening. I remember thinking to myself, I don't know whether there are enough police. I looked at the size of that crowd, the thousands of Trump supporters and rioters clashing with what seemed like just a couple of hundred police out there at the barricades, you know, with very tiny, small bike fences between them and the rioters. And that was the first time I kind of thought to myself, I don't know whether they're ready.
What are you saying at this moment to your colleagues? What, if any, conversations are you having?
Well, we're all looking at this and kind of wondering what was going on. And I remember we were scheduled to be an hour blocks to actually sit in the gallery for an hour at a time. And I remember looking over at one of my colleagues, and as our hour was close to being up, as we saw the mob encircle the Capitol complex and the first barricade start to dissolve, I remember I looked over and said, I don't think we're leaving. I don't think we're going to leave after this hour. It doesn't seem like it's going to be safe for us to go back to our offices. Of course, I didn't realize the extent to which that would be true and exactly what would happen. But in the minutes that followed, because things started to move very rapidly after that, the minutes that followed, became aware of how grave of a situation it was.
Walk us through those minutes. After you say that to your colleague, what happens next?
So what happened was we saw the barricades start to dissolve and break down. There was an outer security barricade. And I actually saw, I was watching on my phone as the rioters breached that. As the police started to move in and try to close their barricade and reestablish a perimeter around the Capitol itself. The first thing that happened was security came in and removed leadership. They removed the speaker down from the dais and took the majority leader and minority leader and minority whip off the floor. And that's when I realized that they were starting to take extra security precautions and that things were getting out of hand. That happened.
What did you see, Congressman? I mean, how did that look from your perspective up in the gallery? The speaker being whisked away, the leader being whisked away, and what were you thinking?
I started to get nervous. That was the first point at which I realized that the security officials had assessed that it wasn't safe for them to be in there, and they were starting to remove the people that they were responsible for protecting. But I still had some confidence that they were able to secure the Capitol complex, but that confidence rapidly eroded because the next thing I saw was the notification by the officers, or heard rather, the notification by the officers to get our gas masks on. And they told us that there were rioters that had breached the Capitol, that had made it into the Capitol complex, and that they were going to deploy tear gas and to get under or reach under our seats and get the gas masks out. It was at that point I realized that they were losing control and that the situation was turning into chaos. So the members both in the gallery on the House floor reached under or getting their gas masks out. That's something that I had done hundreds of times in training in the military, but most of my colleagues had never done it. So I was helping them open up the containers and go through the packaging and show them how to get the mask prepared and how to put it on. But I told them, don't put it on until we're instructed or until I smell tear gas. So I knew that if you put the mask on, that you could pass out if you're wearing it for too long or hyperventilating. So what I said was just get it ready. And I showed many of them how to get it ready. And I told them that if I smelled tear gas, I would tell them to put it on. But until then, just to have it prepared.
What are those conversations like? What are those colleagues saying to you at this moment?
Well, we got the masks out. I could see the anxiety, and I was feeling that anxiety myself in my colleagues' eyes and in their voices. They started to then, the police started to evacuate the members on the floor. And I remember my friend and colleague, Diana DeGette from Colorado, yelled down, "What about us?" Because they were evacuating the members on the floor. And it didn't seem like they were even aware that we were up there, that they had remembered that there was about 24 members that were up in the gallery, that the focus was on the members on the floor. And then Dean Phillips from Minnesota yelled out at that point, "This is because of you," yelled to the Republicans, "that this is happening because of you."
The House will be in order. Okay.
So it was tense. There was a lot of tension, a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. People were getting their gas masks ready. It became apparent from my conversations with the police, but also looking at my phone, that the mob was starting to encircle the House chamber. But what I saw next was actually the most shocking thing, one of the most shocking things I have ever seen.
What happened next?
Well, I looked up. This is after they had evacuated the House floor. So there were no members on the floor. Actually, there were a few that actually remained behind, Mark Wayne Mullen and a few others. But most of the members had evacuated the floor. I looked up and I saw the Capitol Police locking the doors and starting to barricade the doors. And we were still in there. And that's why I realized that there was no plan anymore, that they had lost complete control and we were in really deep trouble. So they were locking us into the chamber. I saw the police scrambling to grab whatever furniture they could grab and start stack it against the main door on the floor chamber. So I immediately kind of converted into Ranger mode. Actually, the first thing that I did before then was I made a decision, like several of us, to call my wife. So I took my phone out and I called my wife and told her that I loved her, that we were surrounded and that I'd either have to make a stand in the gallery or potentially fight our way out, and to tell the kids that that I love them. And she, I remember what she said to me is she knows me. I mean, we've been together for a very long time. And, we first met when I was in the military. I remember she told me that I'm a husband now and a father and I have obligations to the family and that I shouldn't try to be a hero or do anything that would put me in jeopardy. So we finished that call. I hung up, and as soon as I hung up, I kind of got into combat mode. and started to go through a checklist, a mental checklist of what I needed to do.
And what was that mental checklist?
Well, the first was to try to secure the perimeter, right? So I went and started to check on the doors and asked some of the other members to check on some of the doors that I couldn't get to. So to ensure that the doors were locked and as secure as we could make them, there were more doors than there were police officers in the chamber. The second was to try to get the members together, try to get us into a small group so we weren't spread out, and to get us to a defensive position, because if we had to fight, I want to make sure you're together and you're in a tight group. I recommended to the members that we all take our pins off so we weren't identifiable as high-value targets. So if the mob made it in and we had to fight our way out or try to blend in with the mob, they wouldn't be able to see that we were members. Helped folks make sure that they were ready, that they had shoes off if they needed to sprint. So they were leaving their backpacks behind if they needed to. And then I started to coordinate with the police officers on the scene to tell them, number one, that they had to communicate to their commanders that there were members trapped in the gallery, because I was pretty certain that they didn't know we were there. So they had to let them know there were members in the gallery and try to get a sense from them as to where the mob was, whether we were completely encircled. Around that time, I heard the gunshot come from the speaker's lobby. So I knew that there was a violent force being used. I was hearing banging, which I thought was either gunshots or furniture coming from various parts in the gallery. And then also, of course, started to hear the mob try to ram down the barricades, bang on the doors, the breaking the glass, and try to make it through the doors as well.
What are your colleagues saying to you as you're giving out these directions? What is their reaction?
Fear, a lot of expletives. A lot of people were making calls to family, FaceTiming with family, having those calls. I saw my colleague, Susan Wild, in great distress after she had talked to her son. So just wanted to let her know that I was there and I wouldn't let harm come to her and that we would be able to get through this. And we were consoling, each other, because of course we were all very anxious and fearful of what was going to happen. Several of us were getting ready to fight. I tried to find any weapon that I could. The seats are bolted down to the floor, so the only thing that I had was the pin in my pocket, which I would have used if I had to.
People have seen the picture of you consoling Congresswoman Wild. What were you thinking as you're trying to console her?
I was thinking that I was probably going to have to fight my way out.
And I mean, go back to Army Ranger days and serving overseas, and you're thinking, I have to fight my way out. Were you scared?
Yeah, of course I was, right? I mean, if you're not scared in a situation like that, then there's probably something wrong with you, or you don't realize the magnitude of the situation. There was a moment where I was going to ask one of the officers for his firearm. Because I've used firearms before against people. I know that I'm capable of doing what's necessary to protect myself and protect others. But I didn't know whether the officers were, because you just never, my experience in combat is that you never know who's willing to actually pull that trigger and do what's necessary. But I knew that I could. So I was thinking about asking that officer for his firearm. I decided not to, because I didn't want to put the officer in that position. But I never thought that my two lives, I'm a very different person now than I was when I was a Ranger. I'm a father, I'm a husband, I'm a member of Congress. And I thought that when I took that uniform off years ago, that I had left that life behind me. And I've changed. And I never thought it would converge again. I never thought that I'd be in a position of having to think like that and potentially act like that. And certainly not as a member of Congress in 2021, in the House chamber in the United States Capitol, but they did. Those lives came back together again. And that's something that I'm gonna have to deal with in the months and years ahead.
You are gonna use a pen as a weapon. How can a pen be a weapon?
Well, I won't go into the details, but, you know, you can do what you need to do with whatever you have available, you know, whether that's a pen or, you know, other common things. So, and of course, if I needed to ask one of those officers for his gun, I still would have done that. But I would have done what I needed to do to make sure that we got out of that alive, and I was going to protect my colleagues. I wasn't about to let the House chamber be taken over. I wasn't about to let, you know, that mob derail our democracy and hurt my colleagues.
Okay, so Congressman, take us forward now to how this, what happens after you've given those directions and you're in a stance, you're close together, you're ready to fight if you need to. How does this get resolved?
I was communicating with the officers to tell them that we were trapped in the chamber. Eventually, they said that there was a force, a reaction force that was going to come and get us out, that was going to make it through the crowd. So what appeared to be a SWAT team was able to push their way through the riot and clear a path. We got word, they were communicating via radio that that team was on the other side of the doors. So we opened up the doors and started to move out in small groups. So a series of three or four groups at a time were moving out. It was about two dozen members, about a dozen journalists and officers. At the same time, I was coordinating with the few members that were on the House floor that were telling us to all get out. And I remember talking to Mark Wayne Mullen, and I told Mark Wayne that he needed to get out too, because if he was staying behind, that would jeopardize the officer's safety as well. Those officers would have had to have stayed there as well to protect them. And I knew the mob was far, far bigger than anybody could handle. So everybody needed to get out if they needed to protect those officers as well. So eventually everybody got out. I stayed behind to make sure all civilians were out. And as soon as the last journalist and member was out, I followed behind and we all made it to the secure location.
New Jersey Democrat Tom Malinowski was sitting nearby on January 6th. He told us why he was in the chamber when protesters first penetrated the Capitol.
I wanted to be present for what I thought would be a very important but ceremonial event, the recognition, the official recognition by the U.S. Congress of the outcome of the presidential election, critical ritual in our constitutional system. And I knew that there were demonstrations planned. I knew who was doing the demonstrating and that these were dangerous people. But I have to say, I was very confident that the Capitol was secure. Like many of us, I felt, you know, there must be more security here than we're not seeing. And as the meeting progressed and we knew that there were people gathering outside, a couple of times, actually, I stepped out of the chamber with my friend and colleague, Dean Phillips of Minnesota, and we went to some of the windows to just get a view of what was happening outside. And I remember reassuring him when he pointed out how many potential entrances there were and that it was a pretty big crowd. I remember saying to him and then to others when we got back to our seats that we shouldn't worry. This place is a fortress. And the Capitol Police, they're well-equipped and able to handle whatever is going to be thrown at us. And then, of course, none of that turned out to be true. And through no fault of the Capitol Police, in my view, in retrospect, they did everything they could have, and they made the right calls under extreme pressure. But of course, we know what happened next. My experience of it was very different from those watching on television at home. In fact, in some respects, those of us in the chamber knew less than people who were watching around the world because we couldn't see beyond the walls of the chamber. We saw at one point the Speaker Pelosi's security detail whisk her out of the chamber. That was certainly a signal that something was going on.
Do you remember if you said anything to your colleagues around you or think anything when you saw her leave?
Yeah, and at this point, you know, I mean, I was at this point quite angry. I didn't yet realize, I had no clue how bad it was going to be, but I remember feeling quite angry, thinking that there was a clear connection between some of the words that were being spoken on the floor of the House, challenging the legitimacy of a clearly legitimate election, and what was happening outside of the building. And there was a moment at which Dean Phillips, who is a very mild-mannered, pleasant person, just shouted out, "You did this to our Republican colleagues on the floor of the House who were leading the charge to decertify. This is because of you," he said. This.
The House will be in order. Okay.
I agreed with him. I was struck that it was him, of all of us, who vocalized that sentiment, because in some ways he would have been the last person I would have expected, because he's someone with very strong friendships on both sides of the aisle, and someone with a very calm personality. Slow to anger, as they say. And then things devolved from there. We were getting very incomplete and contradictory information about the security situation. At a certain point, the proceedings stopped. We heard from the sergeant at arms that we needed to take out our gas masks, which are found underneath the seats in the House. Most people didn't know how to use the gas masks, or really they didn't understand whether we were supposed to use them or simply take them out.
Tear gas in the rotunda. Please be advised there are masks under your seats. Please grab a mask, place it into your lap, and be prepared to don your mask.
We saw Capitol Police officers racing back and forth to try to secure the doors to the chamber, and then heard that they didn't have the keys to lock the doors. It was very clear at that point that nobody really knew what was happening or what to do. And then a couple of us moved from our seats on sort of the far left, the Democratic side of the balcony, to closer to the center. I reasoned at that point that if the rioters were to break in, they would more likely break in on that side just based on its proximity to an external exit. And so I wanted to get further away from the entrance that I thought was most likely to be breached. The gas masks make a sound, a kind of hissing siren type sound when they are turned on. They have a battery that helps the circulation of the air. And so at a certain point, there are dozens and dozens of masks making the siren sound, which contributed to an atmosphere of tension. At one point, the House chaplain stood up at the podium on the House floor and started praying, which was a good example of a wonderful person doing her job, but in a way that also contributed to an atmosphere of impending doom. And then one of the Capitol Police officers motioned to some of us to exit by the door on what we think of as the Republican side, the right-hand side of the House chamber. So some of us just exited through that door. We got on an elevator. Someone on the elevator pressed the wrong button, which took us down to the most dangerous floor, actually, rather than to the sub-basement. We were heading for the underground tunnel leading to the Rayburn building, but got off on the wrong floor because somebody pressed the wrong button and then took the stairs from there. We did not come face to face with the rioters, although I think reconstructing it, we left at precisely the moment when the gunshots were fired outside or through the speaker's lobby.
As you and your colleagues are traveling in that elevator and then making your way down the stairs, do you remember what is being said or what you're thinking?
I was thinking that stay alert, stay in control, think of the people around me, make sure no one is straggling, make sure everybody's going in the same direction. At this point, again, we do not see what people watching television see, and certainly not the images that we have since seen of the extreme violence outside as brave police officers tried to hold these people off. We just knew that there had been a breach, that there were rioters inside the building, that it wasn't safe, and we needed to get everybody out of there. And so I was thinking, all right, where should we go? Because we had no guidance apart from one police officer who's clearly improvising. And let me make sure that everybody I can see is heading in that direction.
So you have one police officer who's not being told by anybody higher up than him or her to where to take you. This person is...
Well, he was on a radio. I mean, he was in radio communication with others, but the plan of where to take us was clearly being improvised. And so his thought was take us to the Rayburn Building cafeteria. So that's where we headed. We went through the tunnel, paused at the Rayburn end of the tunnel for more confused deliberation among police officers, proceeded to the Rayburn cafeteria. That did not seem safe. I instantly felt that that was not the place where we should be. At this point, there are, I don't know, two or three dozen members of Congress in our group, one police officer, and then I believe the officer or somebody else got word that there was a larger convening in the Ways and Means Committee hearing room, which ended up the place where everybody who'd been in the chamber gathered. And so we then proceeded there, again, without incident, and spent the rest of the afternoon waiting there.
Are there any disagreements happening among you and your colleagues or between others at this time?
Not as we were transiting, no.
But other times there were?
I think most of the people who ended up gathering in the Longworth hearing room, in that Ways and Means Committee hearing room, were of a single mind, and there were Republicans there as well as Democrats. Congresswoman Liz Cheney was there. And there was a group that some of us refer to as the QAnon caucus, kind of huddled in a corner of the room, and there were some disagreements about wearing masks involved in. But I think most of the people in that room shared a sense of the tragedy of what had just happened, and most important, a determination to go back and finish the job. And the moment I got into the Ways and Means room, That's all I could think about. Like, we, whatever just happened, we have to get back in there. The moment it is clear, the moment it is reasonably safe, not 100% safe, not normal circumstances, Capitol Police, double, triple checking that nothing could possibly ever happen to someone safe, but like reasonable for a crisis safe. We need to go back without a moment's delay and finish the certification of the election, because otherwise these guys have won. If they delay us for one night because we went home, that would be a victory. And the most important thing was to show the world that the United States Congress cannot be intimidated and that the United States Constitution cannot be undermined by a mob.
Shortly after 3:30 in the morning on January 7th, lawmakers certified the results of the 2020 presidential election.
The whole number of electors appointed to vote for President of the United States is 538. Within that whole number, a majority is 270. The votes for President of the United States are as follows. Joseph R. Biden, Jr. of the state of Delaware has received 306 votes. Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 232 votes. The whole number of electors appointed to vote for Vice President of the United States is 538. Within that whole number, a majority is 270. The votes for Vice President of the United States are as follows. Kamala D. Harris of the state of California has received 306 votes. Michael R. Pence of the state of Indiana has received 232 votes. The purpose of the joint session having concluded, pursuant to Senate Concurrent Resolution 1, 117th Congress, the chair declares the joint session dissolved.
Thanks for listening to January 6th, Views from the House. Follow this podcast and get all 5 episodes. There's more coverage of the event surrounding the January 6th joint session and the congressional hearings examining what happened on the Capitol that day at cspan.org.